Accession number 28410, Reel 7.
Here are the Japanese. They've got this huge army and navy.
Well, as I say, at that time, I don't think before Pearl Harbor any of us were aware of the nature and extent of the Japanese, other than what we'd read about their invasion of China. Insofar as I personally was concerned, any efforts I made to be sent back to my unit from my instructional job were not acceded to by whoever was in charge. But whilst instructing at the Pakapunyo anti-tank school, I was promoted to a warrant officer. And one evening, whilst I was pulling down a flag outside the headquarters, a jeep pulled up and I noticed the driver was a red tab brigadier who was none other than the original CO of the anti-tank unit in the Middle East. He ordered me to report to his headquarters, which I did, and discovered that I was to be commissioned and transferred to an armoured unit. In other words, from being an anti-tank gunner sergeant, I was to be an officer in tanks. This was quite a change, but he commissioned at least, I think, six or seven of his former sergeants or warrant officers in what was originally the 13th Light Horse Regiment in Gippsland in Victoria, who had become the 13th Armoured Regiment. So the six or so of us who were commissioned were put through a series of courses at the AFB school at Pakapunyo, dealing with driving and maintenance of the General Grant M3 tank, the operation of the wireless in the tank, tank tactics and tank gunnery. I was fortunate in being spared taking part in the gunnery course, as I was able to convince them I'd had enough to do with gunnery to be able to cope with the guns and the tanks. So that for the next period of time, I served with this regiment in training. We moved by rail to the Mergan area of Queensland and were fully equipped there to our complete war equipment level. And then it was decided about sometime in 1944 that tanks would no longer be needed in Australia as the Japs were not going to invade. So the regiment was disbanded and I was posted as officer in charge of an Australian Army instructional school for orderly room sergeants at a town called, or an area called Kabala, outside Toowoomba in Queensland.
What was it like to drive a Grant tank?
Exciting.
Why?
Well, let's face it. The Grant tank had a 9-cylinder Wright Cyclone aero engine in the models that we were driving. You had steering with, if I remember rightly, two levers, one on your left and one on your right, and you had to drive in accordance with the instruction given to you over the intercom telephone system by the commander who was up in the top turret peeking out. As the driver, you had a very limited view of where you were going. And in order to get our army license to drive the tank, when doing the driving and maintenance course at the AFV school, the final test was to drive over a very low-level bridge across one of the local rivers. The bridge had no side rails whatsoever. It was just a flat platform across, I think, probably what was called the Seymour River. So you approach the thing, look straight ahead, and drove across as instructed by your tank commander. Any deviation off course and you'd have tumbled the tank into the river. It was quite a test, really. Just as a matter of a side interest, at one stage later, during field exercises with General Gant tanks, one of our tanks went so close to the bank edge of a river that the bank gave way. The tank fell into the river and the crew of five were drowned.
What, I mean, I understand you had an accident or two in a tank. What can you tell us about that?
The officer in charge of a public demonstration of three Australian-built Sentinel tanks instructed me to take command of the three tanks for a public press demonstration of these tanks. In the course of this spectacular day's demonstration of the tanks, doing all sorts of stunts, I miscalculated the width of a gully and my tank jammed nose first in the gully. And this caused no damage, but it was passed off as a demonstration of recovery of a tank from a ditch. In other words, I got out of the tank, signaled another tank to come up behind me, attached steel tow cables, pulled it out, and proceeded with the demonstration. Is this all what you want?
Yep. I wanted to speak to you in relation to, I mean, you were to stay in Australia, as I understand it, for the duration of the war?
No. After the tour of duty as officer in charge of the sergeants, the orderly room sergeant school at Kabala in Queensland, I moved the school to a place called Wongaville on the Atherton Tableland. And whilst there, I was informed that I had been posted to a position as G Visual Training Officer on the staff of the headquarters of 1st Australian Army in Lae in New Guinea. Initially, I was to proceed to land headquarters at the university in Brisbane for a briefing on the job. And so I went down from Mareeba on the Atherton Tableland to Cairns, and was one of 90 people who boarded a Mariner flying boat for a non-stop trip to Brisbane, where we landed on the Brisbane River. On reporting to land headquarters, they discovered that as I had had considerable civilian experience in the matter of visual education and the use of equipment for that purpose, that I could have a week or so's leave and then proceed to New Guinea by American Air Transport Command from Amberley Airport in Brisbane. My wife, who was a sergeant in the Royal Australian Air Force in the WAF branch, that's the Women's Auxiliary of the Australian Air Force, as a senior podiatrist to the Royal Australian Air Force, managed to hitch a ride on a bomber from Melbourne to Brisbane, and I spent the leave with my wife at the Gold Coast. I then proceeded from Amberley with the American Air Transport Command via Townsville and Port Moresby in New Guinea to Nadjab Airport, which was the then airport for Lae in New Guinea, and took up my duties in the G branch of Headquarters 1st Australian Army at Lae. I served there for the rest of the war, including a short time in Torokina on Bougainville, which was Bougainville Island, which was the headquarters of the 2OS Corps. I did not take part in any offensive action against Japs in that region, either New Guinea or Bougainville, as I was on specialised training duties using motion picture equipment to show training films, etc. Not that many troops at that stage of the war were particularly interested in training, but such it was that with a small staff and mobile equipment, we did do a lot of what might be called propaganda screening of the Why We Fight film series produced by Frank Capra. This was the series which included Prelude to War, The Nazi Strike, Divide and Conquer, Battle of Britain, Battle of China, and Battle of Russia.
When you were doing tank tactics and those sorts of things back in Australia, who was seen at the time as the major threat?
At that time, the purpose of the training with tanks was to have available trained tank regiments in the event of an invasion of Australia by the Japs. For example, at least one tank regiment was transferred to the Geraldton area in the north-west of Western Australia, and remained there for the balance of the war?
Presumably, I mean, you'd heard of the Panzer tank, the Germans tank. How did you take the technology that the Germans were so advanced at and use it within the work you were doing with tanks?
Well, the only two tanks I had anything to do with was the M3 General Grant tank, which was a very high tank and didn't have the low silhouette of some of the German, Russian and other tanks. It was used extensively in the Middle East during the war, but I didn't have any experience with tanks there whatsoever. In all the service our regiment did in the Middle East, I don't think any of us ever saw an enemy tank.
What sorts of tactics were you then to teach, were you then to employ?
You mean in regard to the use of anti-tank guns?
In the use of tanks as well.
Well, the only tactics that I had anything to do with was in the short course at the Armored Fighting Vehicle School in Puckapunyal in Victoria. And we, as a regiment, when we moved to the Mergan area of Queensland, did stage a number of tactical exercises in which we moved by night in an attack on a supposed enemy coming from the vicinity of a town called Kilcoy. We appear to, at that stage, I was acting as the regiment's signals officer and was not involved in travelling in a tank, but had prepared the signal plan for communications during this so-called attack on Kilcoy. As it so happened, we did the whole of the manoeuvre with complete radio silence, and in effect you may say that I felt I went along for the ride.
How had the Japanese been seen in their use of tanks? What was their reputation in the use of tanks that they had?
To the best of our knowledge, the Japanese had used light tanks fairly successfully in their move down the Malay Peninsula to Singapore, although 2-pounder anti-tank guns manned by an Australian crew from the, I think, 4th Anti-Tank Regiment it was there, did destroy a large number of these light Japanese tanks with their 2-pounder gun. The command in Singapore, I believe, had not anticipated, for example, that the Japanese would be able to use tanks in that area. But by the same token, they didn't realise that a substantial number of Japanese troops advanced down the peninsula on bicycles.
Mm.
There was a complete lack, it would appear, of good intelligence on the capability of Japanese troops.
To what degree did you train and work with American troops?
Personally, my only experience with American troops was when I was lent for a few days to the American tank destroyer battalion in Seymour in Victoria. And there they were mostly interested in what I could tell them about action in a war zone, whereas they had not at that stage been involved in a war zone. We did have a competition between their, I think, 37mm guns and our 2-pounder guns at the anti-tank school firing range, where we were demonstrating with 2-pounders knocking 4-gallon empty cans filled with water or fence posts at a defective range. And they were not as successful as we were at that stage, because I discovered that they had not, in effect, zeroed their guns in the same manner as we had zeroed ours. That is, aligned the barrels and their telescopic sights by putting crosswires over the muzzle, etc. This resulted in their being able to knock the tins off the fence posts with the same accuracy as we had.
How would your war see itself out? Where would you be when the war ended?
I was on headquarters of 1st Army in Leyte, New Guinea, when the announcement of the Japanese surrender was made.
What have you heard about the situation regarding the Japanese and the advance of American troops and that sort of thing?
Well, until the bomb was dropped, there was not a great deal of public information about the possible need for an attack on Japan. This would have been, of course, for security reasons.
Some people claim that the tasks that you would be undertaking in places like Leyte, those islands north of Australia, by that stage was unnecessary.
There has been considerable talk that much of the action taken by Australian troops in those areas was or could have been avoided, and the Japs could have been left to starve to surrender. There was a tremendous conflict, obviously, between the Australian General Blamey and the American General Douglas MacArthur. MacArthur wanted to be the only person involved in the reoccupation of the Philippines and did not apparently want Australians to be involved in it. So so that Australians were used in Borneo, and the Americans, I don't think, were. I was not in the Borneo campaign, but my original regiment was. Much of the story of the problem between MacArthur and Blamey is very, very well documented in a book called The Odd Couple, published in Australia.
So what were your feelings when you heard that your war was over and that the Japanese had been defeated?
Well, as I had been commissioned in the Australian Permanent Army, and I had had over 5 years service in the army during the war, we were told there was to be an occupation force sent to Japan, and I was virtually not told but discovered that I would probably be sent to Japan in some role or other in the occupation forces. As my wife had given birth to our first child in July 1945, on her discharge from the Air Force, I was concerned that it looked as though I was going to finish up in the occupation force in Japan, when I discovered that priority for discharge would be given to people with 5 years or more service. And as I had had that, I applied and was granted permission to proceed back to Australia for discharge. So I embarked on the auxiliary naval vessel, the Katoomba, in Lae, and disembarked in Brisbane, and then went by rail to Sydney, where I took my discharge and was placed on the reserve of officers, subject to call up if necessary at any time in the future, until I was subsequently placed on the retired list.
On hearing that the war had ended with the exploding of the atomic bombs, what were your thoughts?
Well, it was looked on as being almost like a miracle. We had not any inkling, of course, that such a device had been prepared, and it was announced to us in New Guinea with a front page item on the army newspaper called Guinea Gold. On Wednesday, August the 15th, 1945, the first special BP edition of this paper had the headline, "It's Over, Unconditional Surrender." Washington, Wednesday, Japan has accepted unconditional surrender. This was announced simultaneously from their capitals by the four Allied leaders at 0900 hours New Guinea time today.
15th of August, yesterday, VJ Day. What was that like? What do you recall of that?
Well, I re- recall only that in the 8th officers' mess in Lae, New Guinea, on that day, most of us had a couple more drinks than we would normally have had.